So imagine what it'd be like growing up with Freddie Mercury as a classmate in school, starting a band with Brian May and Roger Taylor, being quite acclaimed but walking away to pursue other genres and interests, only for Freddie Mercury to step into that role you vacated and watch the band Queen form and dominate the world. How would that impact you? How would you deal with that? And how would you continue to succeed in creative industries? This was the reality for our guest today. Welcome to the Stage Left Podcast. Jumped in joy or sinking in sorrow. Anyway, I should be doing all right. Doing all right. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Go to thestagedeathpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes with the likes of Guns N' Roses, Radiohead, Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, Morrissey, Alanis Morissette, The Damned, The 1975, Bob Dylan, Stone Roses, Jeff Lynne and Kraftwerk. Today we are joined by the original lead singer with Smile, Tim Staffel, who alongside Brian May and Roger Taylor wrote songs that would later be re-recorded to feature in the Oscar-winning film Bohemian Rhapsody. Today we'll be finding out what was learned from observing Jimi Hendrix and Pink Floyd at close quarters when supporting them with Smile, about his friendship with Freddie Mercury. We'll be passing on advice for young musicians in a similar position in aligning careers, and we'll hear about all the early rehearsals with Brian May and Roger Taylor. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Tim Staffel. Thanks for joining us today, Tim. How's it going?
Hey, great. Thank you very much. And thank you for asking me.
Absolutely. So it's been a bit, you know, a crazy couple of years for you, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it certainly has. I mean, I retired from proper adult working in 2014. And I've been, I kind of enjoying myself, you know, ever since. But when the movie came out and I discovered that they wanted me to participate, at least in a small way, I was extremely flattered. I mean, I've always been very flattered that they've included me in the history all the way through. Sometimes I wasn't sure why. Because I would sometimes think back that maybe Deep Purple or AC/DC or any of these bands have got the guy who was previously in them before they made it big, and yet they don't seem to figure in their histories. So why am I?
So why do you think you are?
I don't know.
Have you ever asked, you know, Roger and Brian? I think
it was understandable for the movie, yeah. because the backstory. The backstory was an important aspect to fleshing out the situation, but all the way through, I mean, I suppose it's, and what fans tell me is that the core of the Queen sound exists in Smile.
In what ways do you think, in your opinion, and do you agree with that? Because I've, you know, when I hear stuff, I can totally see the embryonic stages of something that then became Queen, totally.
Oh, well, I mean, I was about to say, it's not my position to really say, not for any coy political reason, but just because actually I can't hear it.
Right.
I can only, with the Smile tracks on that album, I can only really hear the times. I can only really hear 1969 and the shortcomings of the recording techniques and the sort of elementary way the songs were put together, and I can't quite see the derivation. But people's actually, I'm not the one to judge. I guess I'm not the one to judge.
And you said that you discovered that they wanted to get you involved. How did you discover that?
Well, Brian called me up and said, would I like to come down and do the lead vocal for a section of doing all right, that they were featuring in a live scene in the movie, and he sent me the clip. What immediately became apparent to me was that they were hybridising the song from elements that they already possessed. The Queen version, the Smile version, and a semi-re-recorded version that they'd had Jack Roth singing on.
And they Who was the actor who played me?
So they put, and they put that together. And actually what it came out like, I think, this is my interpretation, it came out as if it was modern Queen. And really what they wanted was something that was a bit more, well, a bit rougher.
Yeah.
So call on the bit of rough.
So the phone rang.
Yeah, the phone rang. Phone rang to the bit of rough. Yeah. I thought to myself, yeah, actually their job is to create a track that sounds like it was 70s music without the shortcomings of 70s music, you know.
What were those shortcomings? The availability?
Well, the very fact that everything was recorded on 2-inch tape. Mm-hmm. The clarity wasn't there. Mastering techniques hadn't got the way they have now. But they wanted something that would fit within a modern soundtrack, the 21st century soundtrack, but that sounded a little more raw and earthy and visceral, you know. So that, and because they asked me to play the bass as well.
Interesting.
And I'm a rubbish bass player, so...
Are you really? Because you were a bass player in Smile, right?
Yes, I know, but...
Yeah, you're a good bass player, yeah.
But that, again, that is, you know, that's 40 years ago, and you 50 years ago.
And you haven't really played, haven't focused on the bass so much since?
No, I see. No, I haven't. Although, to be honest with you, I have played bass on my own albums. Mm. Not all the way, but there are some tracks I've played bass on, so yeah, I'm not...
Could you remember your part, your bass part from that song originally, or did you have to rewrite it for the film?
Well, on listening again to the Smile version, I realised that I hadn't remembered it. But what I did do was, I think, adequate. You know, I mean, it was because it was quite simple, straightforward, and fairly gutsy, and that's what was recorded.
And where was it recorded? Did you go to studio?
It was Abbey Road.
Was it?
Yeah. Except again, the whole track was. I suppose it's okay to say this. The whole track was a hybrid.
Yeah.
And it ended up with bits of Queen, bits of Smile, bits of me.
Mm.
But I think it sounds good. I actually think it sounds great. And what I did find astonishing was that since that, there are people that have said to me, oh, I love that song. Wow, do you?
Let's put it on the radar of a lot of people who might not have, you know, heard it before or had the opportunity to hear it before.
Well, also probably with the Queen history and the fact that it's not been exposed for so many years since their first album, maybe it puts it into context more, and maybe it sounds more plausible now. Maybe it's got a.
And how did you find being back in the studio at Abbey Road, given that you kind of paused? I know you've done your own stuff, but were you in comfort zone? Did you feel out of your comfort zone? Did you feel it was a bit of a stretch? Do you feel...
No, I don't. How do I put this? I just kind of take those... I've always just taken those things as they come. That doesn't freak me out. I mean, live gigs don't freak me out. I've never had stage fright. I do fear, but it's usually fear of poverty and things like that.
But I certainly don't
do fear of music, you know.
It's a good place to be.
Yeah, maybe,
because a lot of other people do, I think, you know. That's a great place to be. And at what point did they kind of sit down and talk you through the plot and how they told the story of you leaving, and I put that in inverted commas. Did they sit down beforehand, or did you find out when you went to the cinema?
I found out when I went to the cinema. Well, actually, to be quite honest with you, I found out when they sent me the clip. Okay. Because that clip is the first clip in the movie, it's the first part of the movie. And what sold it to me was the fact that Rami Malek, I don't know how he got hold of this, but he'd somehow got some of Freddie's mannerisms, and I'm some of his social mannerisms, not the ones that you see in public performances. So I suppose he's looked at a lot of. See, Freddie had this. That you know, they talk about Freddie's teeth. Freddie had this way of pulling his front lip over his teeth, like a nervous tick. And Malek does it, and I thought, how the hell did he?
How did he know?
How did he know? Where did he get that from? And actually, I found myself transposing Freddie onto him. I mean, he wasn't his role was interpretative. I mean, it wasn't identical. He wasn't identical to Freddie. Mm. But I became a believer very, very quickly.
Wow.
And I know people say to me, "Oh, yeah, but it's, you know, it didn't happen like that." And you know, Roger never hit anybody or whatever. You know, and I say, "Oh, come on." You know, I mean, because I've made films, I've directed films. I know how, that you have to make a script that is dynamic and that is paced and that tells the story and maintains the emotional integrity of the whole thing. If you step outside the emotional integrity, then you're in trouble. But it was a great film.
So when you saw the telling of, because I think you kind of leave the band and then Freddie's in the car park straight afterwards. That didn't happen, right?
Complete fabrication.
So what did happen? Was there a period of time between you leaving and Freddie stepping in? And
I mean, Freddie and I were mates at Ealing.
We went to college together, is that right?
Or Ealing, Ealing College of Art, which isn't there anymore. Well, it is. The physical building is there, but the course was discontinued. We were both students in the graphics department, and it was I went there in 65. I think Freddie turned up maybe 66 because he was not there for the foundation course. And predictably, we were teenage kids in a period when there was an enormous explosion in amateur musical activity. And we were as sold on it as anybody else was, and with fashion and with the general cultural revolution that existed in London, certainly, well, in Britain, you know, in the world, in the mid to late 60s. So you know, we dutifully did what we were supposed to do for the course.
What did you study?
I mean, graphic design.
Oh, graphic design. Yeah. Right, yeah, okay, cool.
Which involved.
And was Freddie doing that as well?
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Was he good at it?
Yeah. Well, we were all. We were all, well, I think Freddie made a bit of money at it. The only criteria that you need to decide whether you're good at something is whether people will pay you for it, it seems to me. It's money may have a lot of faults, but it can be an honest leveller, you know, in a lot of instances. And people have paid me to do graphics to the present day, and I think the same would have been true with Freddie. We were good at it. We were not perhaps global sensations as graphic designers. We were good jobbing graphics guys. You know, we knew typography, we knew illustration, we knew photography, knew printmaking.
What were you like as students, the pair of you? Like, if I was teaching you. You know, imagine being a teacher, Freddie Mercury. Like, you know, that's.
I had a bloke who taught me lithography. Well, both of us would have had a guy who called Peter Dalgleish, who was our print teacher. Other taught us lithography, and in later years, I saw an interview by him about Queen and about Freddie and about us, and he referred to me in it as, "Oh yeah, Staffel that clown." So I guess you
left a mark on him then.
yeah.
And what was Freddie like as a student? Like, you know, was he well liked? Was he isolated? Was he did he fit in well? What do you remember?
I mean, the thing is, I think it's easy to reflect on those times and assume that there was something special even then that you could... But I have to say, I don't think there was.
Okay.
I mean...
Interesting.
That's not to say that he wasn't talented, because he clearly was, because we were at art college. We would neither of us would have got past the board of directors when we went for our entrance exam if we hadn't been talented guys, leaving the music aside. But it's a mindset, you know. It's creativity is a mindset, I think. God, am I waffling? Is this...
No. I love this.
I mean,
and one of the things I was going to ask is, what do you think you may have learned in, you know, you're at an art school learning kind of graphic design. What skills were transferred, do you think, into music from both your perspectives, do you think, if at all, any?
Confidence. Although I don't know that confidence particularly took shape during the time we were at college, but the skills that we learnt at college and the kind of objectivity that we developed as individuals about the medium in which we were working got transferred into our first working. I'm speaking by proxy for Freddie, but that's without knowing what his experience, his initial immediate experience was. But certainly mine was that once I'd left college, I used to think, oh dear, I'm only average, I'm adequate, I'm average. I can do the work, you know, but I'm average. Look at this guy, look at the famous artist, look at, you know, look at Peter Blake, look at all those guys. They're really good, they're really geniuses. Later on, I realised that it was a matter of perception about what I did rather than an inherent quality or lack of quality about what I did. And I remember being with a load of other artists and suddenly realising that the shortcomings that I was worried about in myself were still prevalent in other people's work. So I suppose it taught me that perfection is a hopeless illusion.
Mm.
And people who swear to you that they're aiming for perfection, well, it's a good thing to aim for, but deep down they know where they fall short. And I'm sure they're happy to let it run, let it ride, you know, because otherwise you wouldn't do anything. If you know.
And was it around the same time that you started jamming and started playing with people and rehearsing, or was it after that period?
No, it was before then.
Oh, it was before then,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, because Brian really... and I had 1984 at Hampton Grammar.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we were kind of seasoned musicians, you know. But we were not writers in that initial stage. So
you're doing covers and stuff, or are you?
Yeah, we were doing. Yeah. Well, I mean, Brian and I started writing in the band 1984. I mean, we wrote "Step on Me," which is on the Smile. Is it on the Smile album? Step on me. I think it's on the Smile album. Anyway, we started writing, so it was embryonic, in that sense. But then Smile came to fruition when Brian went to Imperial College and I went to Ealing.
Mm.
Because Brian and I were always mates anyway. I mean, but more than just musical mates, we used to hang out together and sometimes we went on a holiday together. And when he graduated from Hampton and went to Imperial College to do whatever it was, astrophysics or... whatever, and I went to Ealing, we were in touch, and that's when we decided that we wanted to be a power trio, so we needed a drummer, so we advertised, so we got Roger. So Smile had kind of, you know, semi-professional beginnings, and it had a pedigree before it finally came together. And I suppose it was a good, for the time, it was a good little band, you know.
Yeah, it's got great. You speak to people, and there's like great reputation, like as a cult. I think as a cult thing for Smile. A lot of people like Smile, and I was with someone last night, and he was saying that. And I wonder if it was the same with the kind of the equipment that you were using. But is it true back then that Brian May like built his guitar out of like motorcycle parts and all sorts of bits and pieces? Is this what someone was telling me last night?
You know? I love the motorcycle parts. No, well, no. What happened was Brian lived in Feltham and with his dad and his mum, and. And in those days there wasn't much of a cult of electric guitars, not like there is now.
Yeah.
I mean, And Brian's dad said, look, I've got this mahogany fireplace. I've taken it out, but there's some damn nice wood here. Why don't we make a guitar out of it? And we can spec it completely. Because his dad was an electronics engineer, I think.
Right.
And a craftsman too. And he taught Brian to be a craftsman, you know. So they, by trial and error, put that guitar together. And I mean,
did you play it?
Yeah, I've played it in
how did it feel like this put together? Because is it right the neck got bigger and bigger and bigger at the end? Like,
I never heard that one, but it was a wide neck. It was a wide neck, and I seem to remember that the fretboard, it had a really lovely fretboard. I mean, it is a chunky old beast. I agree, I bet the commercial versions now are different. I bet they have a different neck profile. But anyway, but I swear to God, he somehow had managed to coat the fretboard with like plastic wood or something. So it was a beautiful gloss black.
Slide.
And really nice to play. I don't know whether I've not picked up a Brian May special. I don't own one. Maybe I should buy one. No, he doesn't need the money.
I'm sure we can sort one out for you.
I never even thought of that. I mean, I have to say, I've got my preferences in guitars, and I mean, I collect guitars.
Yeah. And how many you got?
Oh, I've just downsized. I've never had. I've got 18 or 20 at the moment, I think. But I've had 35 before now. But what happens is you just see a guitar and you buy it, and then gradually the ones that get demoted when you buy a better one end up in a pile in the corner, and you think, oh, I better get shot of those then.
But then there's a bit of nostalgia attached to them, and you don't want to get rid of them.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
Was he using a coin?
Sixpence,
as a plectrum?
Yeah.
And he still does that, I think, now, which is crazy. But...
I believe he did. Didn't he get a load of? Didn't he get some made or something?
Oh, did he?
Some discs made.
Right, might have done. But so he was... And what was the reason for that? Was... I mean...
Actually...
Plectrums were available then, obviously, I'm guessing, so...
Actually, I think it might even be a... Brian could shoot this down in flames, but I have a feeling that when he played, he had a way of achieving harmonics on a string by just having the sixpence just protruding from his finger and his thumb, so that as he plucked the string, he caught the back of the string with the edge of his thumb there. And if you do that, you can get a really nice harmonic ping that comes in on the tail end of the note. But to make that sound really good, you need the sound of the string to be the attack of the string sound to be quite aggressive, and a serrated edge of a sixpence would be perfect for that. And what I do is, funnily enough, because I use I use black Jim Dunlop 1mm plectrums, which have a nylon finger grip on them, and I play them somewhat like Brian does. I don't use the pointy end, I use the other side. And I do the same thing, and I'm wondering whether I didn't learn that from Brian. I might have done. And that could be complete nonsense.
No, but maybe not. So I wanted to ask the question, how do you think you personally evolved Queen sound? But we kind of touched upon that, and you were kind of modest about that and said, well, you know, other people have said that, so we won't dive into that. But what I will ask is it true that you kind of then, in those early days, you supported Jimi Hendrix?
Yeah.
And that was under the name 1984.
Well, we did it twice, actually. We did once.
Where was that?
We did once at Olympia on this, it was 68, I think. It was Christmas on Earth Continued. Huge concert. There was the Floyd, Traffic, Hendrix, I can't even remember. Somewhere at home, I've got the advert, the little advert for it. Every sort of band imaginable. And there were two stages, and the bands would alternate. And 1984's, for some reason, got wangled in by, I don't know, some management of somebody or other, and we got taken up Carnaby Street and bought these crushed velvet trousers and guardsmen's jackets and everything that was supposedly hip for the time, and we went on after Jimi Hendrix.
Did you?
5:30 in the morning.
Wow.
We were hanging in rags already. We couldn't, I don't think we were particularly very good.
Do you remember his set? Do you remember watching him from the side of the stage or sound check?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah, I remember his set. I mean,
what were you thinking at the time?
Usual Suspects. I really liked Hendrix. I think in many ways Hendrix was, at that time he was certainly, I mean, clearly he was much more of an innovator than any other guitar player, because, I mean, Clapton, for all his skill, was emulating the Kings, Freddie Albert and B.B. King, and the great blues players, and doing it fantastically. And so was Peter Green, and they all had a vocabulary that they were using, but Hendrix had his own vocabulary, and also he was experimenting with feedback and all sorts of sounds. He was a different animal altogether, and I really enjoyed whether or not he stood the test of time in terms of some of the great jazz players nowadays, I don't know. I mean, actually, yes, you can't take that away from him, but I like to think if Hendrix was alive now, he'd be playing jazz fusion.
Mm.
He would. He wouldn't be playing rock. He'd be playing jazz fusion.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd probably be up to it as well, I reckon.
Great innovator. I mean, some of the stuff he used to do, those ideas from. And Pink Floyd. Did you support Pink Floyd as well?
Yeah, yeah. Floyd were on at that gig.
Oh, the same one, right?
But we also did. I mean, but we also. I got this funny idea that we played at Chelsea Art College, supporting Floyd, and I thought it was their first gig. It can't have been. And I've looked through a list of Floyd gigs and I can't find it anywhere.
Right.
So maybe memory...
Was it Sid Barrett times?
It was Sid Barrett time, yeah, yeah. Who I have to say was made the Floyd for me. I never, after that, I never really got the Floyd.
Yeah, it wasn't your thing.
It's not really been my thing, you know.
But what was it about Sid Barrett?
Great songwriter. Look at those wonderful songs. See Emily Play and The Scarecrow.
Mm.
And what's the other one? Arnold Lane.
Mm.
I mean, poor old Sid Barrett.
Yeah.
Well,
in those early days as well, but while you were in Smile, I think, you went to go and see Freddie play in Liverpool.
Yeah, I did.
What was his band like then, and how did... You know, if you were to compare kind of how people like myself who never saw him live perceive him as a live musician on a stage, how different was he to those first gigs that you saw? And in what ways was he different?
It's really hard for me to remember. the only thing I can do is give you a sort of sense of the emotions I felt at the time. Really, I mean, because I can't really remember the detail, but I just remember thinking that Freddie was about the performance, and regardless of what I thought of his singing at the time, which I can't remember, he was performing. He was entertaining. What Freddie had and what I never had was the clear understanding that he was there to entertain. And I mean, I'm afraid I used to think, no, I'm here to play my music. No, you're not. You're here to entertain. And Freddie.
Do you think that's true? Do you think that there isn't room for both in musical landscapes?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, of course there is, but not if your job is the front man. I think. I mean, I'd say, I was bass player and singer in Smile, but because I did the majority of the lead vocal. Well, actually, no, I didn't. Did I? Maybe people in retrospect think I did because I was replaced by Freddie, and I seem to have in retrospect fulfilled the role of, oh yeah, he was the singer beforehand. And Rod used to sing, Brian used to sing, but maybe I could have got away with it. I mean, the only thing that possibly could have happened, I think, with that is that I could have stayed and Freddie could have joined, and that might have worked.
Could you have stayed on as a bassist? Because John Deacon came afterwards, didn't he? Do you think you could have carried on in that band as a bassist?
Probably, because I probably would have got enough singing jobs, gigs within the repertoire to have satisfied me. And then if Freddie had been there, he'd have done a few, well, I don't know, maybe he would have played keyboards. Who knows?
And when Queen did, they end up doing the song Doing All Right, yeah?
Yeah.
How did you feel about that?
Do you know, I didn't hear it for years.
Right.
And
so Freddie was on vocals, yeah. And they did a brand new version of
it's
it.
It's a really sweet version of it. I mean, which is what surprised me. Because with us, there was that middle, that raunchy middle bit. And I think I'd seen it a bit more yesterday. Yeah. You know, kind of... Well, I wouldn't say aggressive, but a little more forceful. But that's not to say that their version isn't great. I mean, it is.
Did they not have to get permission from you?
No, don't think so.
Did you feel, you know, I guess the song that you've kind of been that close to and involved in seeing it being covered, you didn't have any issues with it? Because, like, you know, the original harmonies on and stuff are very kind of Queen-like and stuff like that, you know. Did you...
Yeah, no, I didn't. But do you know what I thought? I always thought, and I probably still do, really, that they're coming up to their first album. It's not unusual for a band coming up to record its first album to discover they haven't got enough tracks of their own. You know, they haven't got enough. So
they're looking down the back of the sofa, weren't they?
So it's possible that they said, oh, well, we need one more track. Oh, well, we could could use the Smile one. We could,
Bit naughty, though.
Must we? No, I'll try and write one over the weekend. Oh, I'm sorry, guys, couldn't manage it. We'd better do the Smile one. Yeah, all right then, okay.
Which just seems a bit unfair on yourself, but, you know, particularly they didn't get permission. That's all I would say.
It had already been published, so yeah, it was okay. So it was only going to be good for me. I was only going to get royalties out of it, you know, so...
You once described yourself, you know, when Queen started kind of really ascending, as kind of being extremely envious. How would you advise someone if the same kind of history played out, how would you advise someone to deal with that? Because that must be very difficult. I'm a very envious and jealous person. And if, you know, you see an ex-girlfriend with someone, I'll get, you know, and to see that on that scale, Live Aid and stuff like that, I empathise with that. That must have been very difficult.
Well, I was never... You see, we did definitely go two different ways musically. Yeah. I mean, I fell into the world of improvisation and the world of jazz, and I it by the mid 70s, it was becoming obvious to me that if I was going to continue as a musician, then actually I'd better learn a lot more about it than I already knew, because I certainly couldn't improvise as well as I can now. Yeah. I mean, and that's what I like. And I loved when we were working with Jonathan Kelly's band. I mean, admittedly, Jonathan Kelly's band was a band of amazing players, absolutely amazing players. I was a backing singer. I did some vocals and I played percussion. They wouldn't let me near any musical instruments because, I couldn't have hacked it. But we used to, every night we'd do, the songs would be different. They'd be radically different. The solos would be different. The riffs would be different. The improvisation would be different. And I just loved it. I just really enjoyed that kind of stimulation. And I think what I'd say to people who find themselves in that situation is music is the goal, not notoriety. Although when you got into it, maybe that's why you got into it because you thought it was a good way to impress the chicks or maybe impress the guys, I don't know, or both, or whatever's your bag, you know. But that, actually, that isn't it. Music itself is a most amazing thing. Mm. Music is a universe of vibration and harmonics that is so interesting and so absorbing that just dive into that. Don't worry about that. Just become a real musician. You know, that's the antidote to jealousy. Become a real musician.
Brilliant. What's the best bit of advice someone's given you?
I think it's probably a bit of advice I didn't heed.
Oh.
And it's really got nothing to do with music either.
It's okay.
I've been directing commercials for about 2-3 years, and the company I was working for went down the tubes, owing me a fair bit of money. I had a wife and a young son, I think, maybe two young sons, I'm not quite sure. My only real option was to go back to being a model maker, which is how I'd start, how I'd made the transition from music back into art, was by way of being a sculptor, being a model maker. And then I'd progressed into direct, actually animating and directing commercials, and bits and pieces. And someone said to me, don't go do a retrograde step back into your previous career. Stick with this one. Borrow money if you have to survive, but stick with the level you've reached. And I wish I'd listened to that, because if I could have just weathered the storm, weathered the financial storm for a while, as it was, I almost had to start from the ground up again by just going back to being a maker rather than a manager or rather than a director of making.
Would you have been able to walk straight into a director of making if you hadn't have done that, though, do you think? How long could you have weathered that storm for, realistically? Or was that part of the progress, the fact that you had to start again? Or
I think what I should have done is, I mean, the lesson really is to persevere. It's to just persevere. And if the option comes up to do something or not do it, do it. Mm. Don't ever think twice about it. Do it. Just do it. Don't say, oh no, I don't think. You know, I don't think I could. I don't think I'm capable of that. Yes, you are, because what will happen is the interaction between you and the environment that you are attempting to negotiate will mould itself to your own methods, and actually you'll be successful because people understand where you're coming from, they'll understand your rhetoric, and you'll be able to negotiate it successfully. But I bottled out. You see, I bottled out, and I went back to. Well, I suppose, you know, I needed money. I needed to live.
There's a lyric in Sudden Moves, one of your songs, where you quote, I think a woman said to you, the only way to live is to keep doing things you regret. So what are the regrets that made you feel most alive at the time?
That's funny, that, because that's actually one of my favourite lyrics. And funnily enough,
I was about to
re-record that song.
Oh, right, nice. Yeah,
with my current band.
Right, nice one.
Yeah, oh, wow.
It's a great lyric. The only way to live is to keep doing things you regret. So what are the regrets you've had that have made you feel most alive?
My God, that's the most difficult question I can imagine.
Good, thank you.
Instead of saying what, because I don't know, or maybe I can come to the... Maybe I can find them by saying this, that the reason I wrote that lyric was because I had a view of the woman who steps into his car. I had a view of portraying her as kind of a someone who's on the periphery of society, who maybe has slightly criminal tendencies. What I didn't write into that song, which I probably should have done, was I probably should have given her more of a sexual identity, but I didn't. But I was thinking it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that actually that's what is characteristic of people who are on the periphery, criminals, and they just keep doing things that they regret. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance... prisoners who come out of prison immediately reoffend, which they regret, but it's their only option to get a bed and a meal again is to get
3 square meals a day
back inside. So it's kind of, I think that was kind of, it was this little social pot there.
Mm.
But as for things that I've done that I've regretted, well, what keep doing things I regret, actually, that, backing off, don't back off, you know, that's the answer there, going back to the previous career.
Yeah, yeah. And in that career, you worked on Thomas the Tank Engine.
Mm.
Did you make the trains, or did you, what were you doing?
Basically, Clearwater Films, which is down the road in Battersea.
Yeah.
At the time, it was the premier stop frame filmmaker in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Aardman took over Clearwater's crown in about the mid 80s, but certainly Clearwater at one time were the absolute apotheosis. Whatever that means. they were the pinnacle of. Yeah. Stop frame. So I went there because I'd been working in effects for a while, and I knew someone who worked there. They got me in there, and I started working, and I had my feet under the table, and we did lots of really prestigious British commercials for a couple of years, and then they got the gig to do Thomas the Tank Engine. So first of all, we shot the pilot. Now, I mean, there's a team of about 12 of us. But there was a lot. There was 30, at least 30 model makers working there. Wow. The rest of them carried on with the commercial side of it, doing ski, yogurt, bird's eye, Lego, all the 30-second commercials. And we concentrated. We took one of the workshops over, and we concentrated on building Tommy the Tank. We used the books, the Audrey reference books. And we got a big shed built outside in the back where we did the sets, and then we built the models inside the main workshop. And we all had a bit to do. We all did bits. I did all the faces in the first series, yeah. And all the little characters.
Fat Controller.
Fat Controller.
And so when I was little, my mum used to think I was... So I was saying, I love the fucking troller. It's like a joke in our family, the fucking troller. It's like running around as a three-year-old. Oh, the fucking troller.
I made some of the engines themselves. I designed the smoke machine. In the pilot episode, the smoke machine was very dodgy. The pilot episode, we had a car cigarette lighter and a little system of dropping smoke oil onto an incandescent car cigarette lighter. Well, what happened there was it got so hot that the body started to, because they're plastic, you know.
Yeah.
The body started. Well, for the main series, I invented this little. It was quite simple. A little glass container which we had blown at Imperial College, with an inlet that went down to the bottom of the glass, a little pipette went down to the bottom of the glass container, completely enclosed container, and an outlet which came out the top. And we filled it with titanium tetrachloride, which smokes on contact with air.
Oh, nice.
And then fed it a little tube to a diaphragm pump driven off the wheels. And then the other tube came out and up the smokestack on the, so that it was puffing. And it did. It filled the studio with the acrid smoke. And all the film crew, the sparks and the electricians were, and the lighting guys were all saying, "Well, I'm not going in there." And actually, it turned out that it was only an irritant. So as long as you've got a paper mask on, you're okay. It wasn't toxic.
And at what point did you find out that Ringo was going to be narrating it? I mean, that is a ridiculous bit of casting. Like,
it's, I don't know.
It's like, what the hell?
I don't know. I never met him. Met him because of that. Through that, I think.
Did you know at the time this? Because that obviously made the program quite much more high profile than it otherwise might have been.
I suppose it did. I never thought about that.
A Beatle narrating it. It's like, what the hell?
They must have done that. It would have happened within the. Because it was a 13 episode series which we built over the space of a year, 18 months or something. They must have announced it in the middle of that. They would have said, "Oh, and guess who's narrating it? It's Ringo." Oh, was it really?
Yeah.
Because he only did the first series, didn't he? And then
he
went over to Michelangelo, the guy who's also got this thick Liverpool accent,
right?
Who was in, Mike Lee's films.
Oh, okay,
From Mike Lee's films. But, I mean, I never would have thought that that would have lasted so long.
Well, I think they still do it. Yeah. I've got a nephew now who's, got Thomas Tank Engine pyjamas and stuff like that. It's like, there you go. It's crazy. Yeah. And as a musician during that time, it was interesting. I was going to ask, you know, when you went to do those jobs, where is your creative outlet? But actually hearing you talk about some of the problem solving you doing there, that was probably felt like it was a very creative outlet anyway. Was there any, did you just stop doing music or did you kind of just have in the background?
Playing.
Oh, you still did it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I was playing with scratch bands and little outfits all the way through, you know. Well, because actually it wasn't unusual to find musicians in that role of model makers. I know a lot of musicians who actually were model makers.
Yeah.
You know, and we'd often I'd do pubs and I mean, most of it was fairly uninspiring. You know, but
what's your most important piece of music memorabilia that you own? So, you know, it might, and you're not allowed to answer a guitar here. So let's say the house is burning down, all your family and friends are safe, everyone's okay. What's the thing you want to save most that's music memorabilia to you?
Well, actually, I think probably I'd have to save all the CDs I've got of my own, you know. The Smile, the Morgan, and everything. I try and get hold of everything I've worked on, really.
Have you not got it backed up anywhere?
Yeah, it's all backed up, but you know, there's something about a little physical object.
You've known, obviously, so you went to Hampton with Brian May, is that right?
Yeah.
So you've known him from what age? What, 13, something like that?
Yeah.
Through to now?
13 or 14, yeah.
How does someone going through this crazy, weird world of fame, and I say that in inverted commas, seeing someone before and then seeing the end product, How does it change people, if at all?
That's it. I think the significant thing is if at all. I mean, we always used to... I mean, Brian, at school, and I'm sure he would... forgive me for saying this, but at school, I pictured Brian as kind of a lovable nerd, a very highly skilled, lovable nerd, you know. and I kind of don't see much difference now. He has a highly developed social conscience,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I think he had in those days too,
mm-hmm.
Insofar as a schoolboy with their own concerns can have a social conscience. He doesn't suffer fools gladly.
No.
He's completely nerdy about three-dimensional photography, about astronomy.
Astronomy massively,
and all sorts of things that I also find interesting, you know. So I guess I don't think he's changed much at all.
And Roger?
I haven't seen Roger in years.
Mm.
Last time I saw Roger, although he did email me a little while ago just to say, how are you? But I actually haven't seen him since. There was a time when my wife and I used to go to his firework parties when he lived out on the A3, just outside Guildford, which were fairly legendary.
Why?
And actually, the funny thing about Roger is that in a strange way, I always kind of felt a little bit more affinity with Roger on a kind of emotional level than I did with Brian, in a sense, because I think there was an element of Roger's personality was slightly Jack the Lad, in exactly the same way that I've got an element of Jack the Lad in me. It doesn't pop out very much, but it's there. It's a bit of a disposable. I could be PC. I could be non-PC. Sorry,
yeah.
I could be non-PC at times if I don't think about what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling Roger could be the same, you know. But it was all right. It was. But I haven't seen him for. The weird thing is that I went to Japan just recently, and someone had picked up on this story that I'd, when I was a model maker, I'd done the cover of Roger Taylor's Fun in Space album without knowing who it was for.
Is that true?
It is true.
Oh, wow.
And they were fascinated by this. And the story is that when I was working at a prop house in the late 70s, there were no specialists in those days. Whoever client came in the door, whoever was free, got the job.
Mm.
If it didn't matter if it was metal work or woodwork or sculpture or foam work or anything, costume work, you'd get the job and you'd have to do your best to learn the techniques to build it. So someone came in and they got this comic, I think it's called Creepy Worlds, with this little alien character on it. And they said, look, I want you to make that alien about life size or whatever. About life size and
a life size alien. As if we know what size
of
alien it is.
Yeah. So I made this sort of head of the thing, and I made it out of fiberglass and put illuminated and put eyes in it and the whole thing. And then that was about a month's work, I suppose. And when I finished it, the client was delivered to the client. I got paid. End of story. Forgot all about it. Some years later, maybe 5 years later, I'm round Roger's house at a party, and there on the mantelpiece is this alien. And I said, what the hell are you doing with that? And he said, that was the cover of my album, Fun in Space. What? And I'd never seen this album or the cover or anything. So I said, you're kidding me. I made that. And he said, no. And so,
what are the odds on that?
Yeah, I know. And... because the client was Hypnosis, who did that. And the cover was, the front of the cover was that was the alien reading this comic with a, no, was Roger reading this comic with the alien on it, and the back of the cover was the alien reading the comic with Roger on the cover. Nice. I mean, it was kind of cleverish, you know.
When you were in a band with Roger, did you know he was, like, going to be such a good songwriter? Because, like, I think for a passive music fan, you know, people who don't really know a lot about Queen, you'd be surprised, like, people might just assume the songs are written. But I went to one of Spike Edney's gigs recently at Shepherd's Bush.
Yeah.
And, like, Roger came out and started doing Under Pressure.
Mm.
Turned to a mate of mine who's, like, a Queen super fan. And I was like, oh, you know, this is a great song and stuff. He's like, you know, he wrote this. And I was like, what?
Gosh, I didn't know that myself.
He wrote Under Pressure.
Wow.
What a fucking brilliant song. Yeah. And, I mean, a lot of people think the bass, boom, 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 boom. But that was added on afterwards. But, yeah, he wrote Under Pressure, which is incredible.
Wow.
Yeah, there you go.
God, when you think of the number of times it's been sampled.
Yeah, and the he wrote the harmony part as well for Bowie to sing as well, because when they did it a couple of weeks ago, he sang the Bowie part, and the Justin from Darkness sung Freddie's part. And he wrote that.
Amazing.
There you go.
Yeah.
So very, very talented guy. And
absolutely. He wrote Radio Gaga, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah.
I mean, that was, for a long time, that was easily one of my favourite songs. I mean,
which gig have you ever played that you wish you were in the audience for?
Have I ever played?
Yeah, so think of a gig that you played. Like, what was the one that you think, oh, I wish I'd been in the audience for that?
Probably the reunion with the Cross in 92. Because...
Tell us about that.
Well, that was very strange. It's also rather topical, which I'll get to in a minute. Again, they phoned me up and said, do you want to... I mean, this was only a year, I suppose, after Freddie passed. They said, look, do you want to come and do a couple of numbers for the Cross's Christmas party? We're going to have loads of guests. Brian's coming along. And we got Roger Daltrey, and I just can't remember. And they said it's two nights at the Marquee, and this was the new Marquee in Charing Cross Road. So I said, right. And I know I said earlier that I don't do stage fright. That was probably the closest I came to being a bit anxious.
How did it manifest itself?
Well, because the thing is that, and in fact, even to this day, I've never really been used to this regime whereby the musician turns up, gives his guitar to the sound tech, and doesn't see it again till he goes on stage. I mean, I carry my own gear into gigs. You know, I set my own PA up. I still do it, and so as soon as I lost my guitar to the sound tech, and they said no, we're going to eat now. And I thought, hang on a minute, I don't do this. Normally, my head's in the gig space for the few hours before the gig, but it couldn't be that. But they don't do that because they're so experienced in performing that they don't need to.
No,
the confidence is transposed onto the technical crew, the stage crew. I've never had a stage crew, you know. And although I admit the first night, I will admit to a surfeit of alcohol, resulting in a possible malfunction of the legs.
We've all been there.
There were fortunately some very attractive backing singers on hand to keep me upright. I heard a little while ago someone sent me a recording of that, which I hadn't. I've only ever seen the some clips on YouTube. Mm. Someone sent me a recording of If I Were a Carpenter from that night.
Right.
A decent quality.
What, a desk? Was it a desk recording?
It must have been.
Yeah,
it
yeah,
must have been.
Yeah.
And I actually thought to myself, God, it wasn't a shambles. It's good. And it's a good version. It's really good. In fact, I'm thinking of doing If I Were a Carpenter in this current band.
And tell us about this current band.
Well,
is it because you are you doing on a are you doing a third album called Zero Margin?
Yes, I am. But
and is on, this something different?
This is something different. Oh, okay, cool. Or No Margin. I'm thinking of calling it No Margin. Or okay. I might change my mind altogether.
Okay.
The title No Margin stems from a realization that we're approaching we're approaching a point in my life where the leeway that is rapidly being eroded. I mean, it's getting to the point where I better get a move on, if you see what I mean. Mm. But I've been working for the past 4 or 5 years with some of the guys who were in the Others, that was the other school band at Hampton.
Oh, okay.
But there were two school bands at Hampton. One was the Others, mm-hmm. and one was 1984. Mm-hmm. Both bands were decent bands. The Others became the Sands and were managed by Brian Epstein.
Right, wow.
So they had a pedigree. They had a very serious pedigree. But in later years, I met up with them, with three of the guys, and we formed a band called Big Steam, and we've been gigging around. And just mainly doing retro 60s blues covers and a bit of original stuff. Because the members were living so far apart, I started a duo with the singer, the Paul Stewart, who was at Hampton, who was the singer with the Others. And Paul and I really kind of hit it off in terms of where we are musically. Mm. And since then, Paul and I have gone out as a duo with the occasional rhythm section.
Nice.
And we don't use one rhythm, we use several rhythm sections from time to time. But we're doing an album in November with the guys that with our preferred guys, two drummer and bass player,
nice.
Steve King, Paul White. And what we're doing is we're doing four of my songs, four of Paul's songs, and four blues standards. I know that we needed to get this music down.
Yeah.
And then in the new year, I'm going to start work on No Margin. So
cool.
So there are two albums coming up.
Awesome. You once said, "I'm so glad I didn't go on the road because I just couldn't cope with it."
Oh yeah.
Why?
Well, I've got this memory of being in a. Actually, this was with. I think this might have been with Morgan. I was in a hotel room, Manchester or somewhere, and it was pouring with rain, and I was just, and there was nothing to do, and we had a gig the evening, and I was looking out the window, and I just got this sense of desolation. My wife was at home, this was before we were married, but she was still at home, and I just thought, there's no human comfort here for me. You know, there's no friendship, no. There was the friendship of the band, but they weren't in the room. They were doing whatever they were doing. And
it's a sense of isolation?
Sense of isolation, yeah. And insecurity, you know. And I wasn't doing something that was earning me a massive amount of money either, you know. So I just thought, God, you imagine what it must be like to be on the road for, like, a month, 6 weeks.
And the rest, and the rest, yeah. Some do for 6 months at a time, yeah.
Not for me, thanks.
Yeah.
You know, well, at least I suppose you could qualify that by saying, not at this level of frugality.
Yes, yeah. So if you get millions, and
it's a different matter. Yeah.
What's the most important guitar you own, and why?
Oh.
Or the most important guitar to you.
At the moment. At the moment, I play. Every guitar I've got is fantastic at the moment. But the one that most reflects, I think, what I've been playing over the last few years is a Fender Cabernet Telecaster, which is a thin line, that is to say semi-hollow, Fender Telecaster with Filtertron pickups, which are of the Gretsch style variety. It kind of sits between blues and country blues mm-hmm. in its sound. And if I lost that, I'd be hard pushed to replace it without getting another one. And I wouldn't be that confident that they would be the same, because the problem with makes of guitars is that they're not all the same.
Yeah.
Two Fender Telecasters are not identical. Mm. Two Les Pauls are not identical, even though the spec may be the same, you know.
What's the most surreal experience you've had in the music industry?
Going to Japan about a month ago. Because up until then, I hadn't realised the degree to which my legacy involvement with the band had meant to some people, especially not, I've never been to Japan before, especially not these wonderful people, young girls being so adoring. Well, on a cultural level, let's say, yeah. let's be sure about that. And I found myself in a situation where I did some interviews, I did a radio show, I did some signings, and I was confronted with an endless queue of people who were complimentary, pleasant, gave me gifts.
Wow.
Said that the song had meant so much to them personally in their lives that I was kind of gobsmacked, to be honest. You know.
Were you expecting that at all? Were you given a heads up that there was an audience like that in Japan for your music?
Well, the Getting Smiler album was released in Japan, so I knew that there was interest in Smile, but it's one thing knowing it as an academic fact and actually being face-to-face with it. Well, even being... I mean, when this happened, when this thing happened with the film, I immediately, call me cynical, I immediately merchandised it. Because I own the copyright of the Smile logo, I got some Smile t-shirts printed.
Yeah.
And I got some little badges
pins,
made.
Yeah, I saw them on your website. Yeah, they're cool.
And they started to sell. Mm. And they sold, and I got I got bulk orders from Japan.
Oh, nice.
And then after I'd sold, I mean, we're not talking about thousands, we're talking about a few hundred. So, you know, it's still relatively modest. But then I had an email from Japan saying, we'd like to invite you over.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's only there for a week, but so, and when it was approaching, I was in a state of some, well, I was bemused, you know, and I thought, is this really happening? I mean,
not Beatlemania, the film mania.
I just hopped the plane, went to Osaka. I mean, I had a really good translator guy there. If it hadn't been for him, he was another guitarist, Australian guitarist, lovely guy. If it hadn't been for him, it would have been a lot more difficult.
Yeah,
but
it's a great place. I've been to Japan. It's a fucking amazing place. Oh, I can imagine if you were experiencing it like the way you were experiencing it too. It would have been incredible.
Oh, it was, and of course on the third day we took the bullet train to Tokyo, and I did another series of signings there. And in the evening, Morgan Fisher, who was the keyboard player for Morgan, he lives in Tokyo.
Nice.
So he came, and we had dinner, and that was a buzz, such a buzz.
How great are the bullet trains, by the way?
I've got a photograph of the top speed on them.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. okay, last question.
Yeah.
If you could call yourself from 40 years ago, make a telephone call to yourself from 40 years ago, and you had 1 minute on the phone to yourself, what would you say?
I don't know how to put this, but I have nothing to say. I have no advice to give. My life has been what it is. I could not advise my younger self to take any other route. I'd just say, yeah, it's been fun. Hello, it's been great. Watch out for a few bumpy rides, but dig it.
Phone down.
Yeah, phone down. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for appearing on the Stage Deaf podcast, Tim. It's been great fun, and thank you for sharing kind of your wisdom and your insight and your advice for young musicians. We look forward to hearing whether it's going to be called Zero Margin or No Margin coming up, and we'll be checking all that out. But we hope you have enjoyed appearing on the Stage Deaf podcast.
That's been fantastic. Thank you very much. The vibe is excellent. I love it. Thank you.
Great stuff. So thanks to Tim. He's going to be doing one of our Stage Deaf Supper Club nights where you can sit alongside Tim and enjoy a 5-course gourmet meal cooked by the award-winning chef, Davila J. And between the 4th and 5th course, Tim will pull his chair back and in front of the rest of us, he'll play a few songs within touching distance in our lounge in London. There's only room for 8 of us, so it's a very intimate experience. So if you're interested in a fan of Tim, want to come along, drop us an email to stageleftnights@gmail.com to get involved. And obviously check out other episodes of the podcast. So if you're a Queen fan, check out the one we just did with Jamie Moses on a decade in Queen. So many amazing stories. And we've also got other episodes with the likes of Tony Visconti, Stuart Lee, Steve Cropper on writing Sitting on the Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, Wolfgang Fleur of Kraftwerk, Billy Burnett of Fleetwood Mac, and loads more. So go to thestagedeafpodcast.com for that. Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter at The Stage Deaf Pod. Like us at Facebook at facebook.com/stagedeafpodcast. And check out our Instagram. So all the photos and behind-the-scenes stuff from the interviews are on our Instagram page at The Stage Deaf Podcast. You'll find us on there. Okay, the next episode is going to be with Fraser from Jungle. How exciting is that going to be? So we'll see you next time.